minutes for rebuttal.
All right, then we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready.
May it please the court, Brad Haywood for Brian Turner, the appellant in this matter. As the court is aware, one of the central issues in this case is the attachment, removal, and reattachment after a 15-day period of a GPS tracker on the vehicle of my client, Brian Jeffrey Turner.
Let me see if I can clarify something, because we have a statute, and we also have, I guess, a constitutional issue. As I understand your first argument on appeal, the contention is that the second order that was issued constituted a second search. Is that correct?
The second attachment would have constituted a second search.
But it was pursuant to a second order that was entered by the
second
court.
The second attachment was pursuant to the first search warrant. There was a...
But there was an extension granted.
There was an extension after the second attachment.
It was after the second attachment?
I believe so, yes.
Are you sure? Because that's not clear to me. So I was that was actually my question: is what was the timeline on how that?
I believe it was.
Okay. In the abstract, if we were to find that the statute wasn't honored procedurally in some way, how would that impact on the constitutional issue, if at all?
If the statute weren't honored in some way, I think that the statute is meant to. Speak to the spirit of Jones. I know it was
that's clear,
enacted.
But I mean, the statute does not contain any exclusionary remedy. So it seems to me the only application of the exclusionary rule would come if there was a constitutional violation. Would you agree with that?
I think that Jones was silent on a number of matters, and one of the matters it was silent on was the second component of the test, well, the second test that not necessarily at the center of this case, which is the privacy test under Katz. So the statute sets forth issues, for example, how the duration of surveillance and what duration maybe could exceed.
But following up on Judge Humphrey's question, that goes to the constitutional issue. The specific question is, if you can demonstrate a violation of the Virginia statute, that does not provide for the exclusion of evidence, correct?
I did not argue that in my brief.
All right, go ahead.
So, Your Honor, I believe that answering the question of whether this reattachment was a lawful or unlawful act requires examining the nature of it. And that, as I mentioned, United States versus Jones controls in that regard. In Jones, we had the attachment of a GPS tracker, and the Supreme Court found that was a search. And it found it was a search due to physical trespass theory. And it was much more than just a theory. It wasn't operating as if it were some sort of analogy that didn't have practical application. What it was stating was that the actual act of the physical trespass is what mattered. That act is the act for which probable cause is required, and the physical placement of a tracker on private property, therefore, is like I mentioned, a trespass. Because a trespass under common law, it's a trespass for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, and it requires a finding of probable cause and a search warrant. From that starting point, it's easier to understand why the GPS tracking here would have been unlawful. We have a warrant that also authorizes one entry, one trespass into the vehicle. Once that tracker was removed, the trespass concluded, as did the search. Each subsequent entry, therefore, finds a finding of probable cause and a new warrant.
Does this, understanding the trespassory nature of creating, that's when you need to get the warrant. But the search was anticipated by the warrant to last more than the mere trespass, wasn't it? It was intended to last for 30 days.
It was.
And so the search isn't just the placing of the device, it's receiving the information from the device, correct?
Yes, and I think that Jones addressed that, again, in mentioning that the trespass test wasn't meant to completely supplant the privacy expectation of privacy test under Katz. It meant to complement one another. But in addition, the trespass test does not admit or permit any exceptions solely because of the Katz test. It's not as if the physical trespass is lessened. Yes, sir.
I think we can all agree that in the wake of Jones, the we've got a pretty muddy situation now with respect to Katz versus Jones. How far have we gone back to the old pre-Olmstead trespassory, analysis of Fourth Amendment issues? But setting all that aside for the moment, let me see if I can put this in a hypothetical that maybe I can wrap my arms around, maybe you can help me work through it. If we were to take a basic search. Forget the unique properties of a GPS device. Just take a basic search situation. A court issues a warrant, or a magistrate issues a warrant to search, let's say, a premises, a house. And the warrant is properly executed, and the warrant allows the search of the premises for, you know, something that could be found pretty much anywhere inside. And the search is conducted, but for whatever reason, inadvertence on the part of the executing officer, they overlook a bedroom. They just forget to look into a bedroom, and they walk out the door and get halfway back to the street to their patrol car, and the officer says, "Oh, I forgot to look in that bedroom." Can they go back under the color of the existing warrant, and is it within the scope of that warrant to go back and search that room?
I discussed that a bit in my brief, Your Honor, and I think that it depends on the circumstances. I think that if it was all in one day, or if it was the morning after, case law does suggest that's permissible. But it all has to be within a time frame and under circumstances that it would suggest it's a continuation of the same initial entry.
From a constitutional perspective, setting aside the statute from a constitutional perspective, the Fourth Amendment contemplates and says, by its very terms, get a warrant based on probable cause. So if you go to a court, and by the way, I think the jurisprudence is pretty clear, and I think you probably agree, that the law is to encourage police officers to go to magistrates or judges and get warrants and not conduct warrantless searches, because they're presumed to be unconstitutional. So you go and get a warrant, you get a judge to sign off on your probable cause. And I don't really think there's any serious contest here that there was probable cause at the time the warrant was issued. So it seems to me the real issue is, was the scope of the original court order here exceeded, if it's akin to a warrant? And so if that's the case, and you have probable cause, and you're still within the time frame or the scope of the original warrant, forget the statute for a moment, but does the Constitution care? Does the Fourth Amendment care? As long as you have that piece of paper signed by a judge, supported by probable cause, and you're still within the scope of that piece of paper, does the Constitution care about anything other than that?
I do. I think it does, Your Honor. I think that each, according to the language of Jones and subsequent cases, that we have each trespass requires a finding of probable cause, and each one is a different act. You'll find another way that one can look at this is what happens.
I think that the presumption, and maybe you're right. I'm trying to get you to help me work through this. You may well be right, but it seems to me that, at least questionable, that what the Fourth Amendment, even under the old Olmstead analysis, which required the analysis was that the Fourth Amendment didn't protect privacy, it protected property, essentially. And if that's the case, it isn't the number of trespasses that take place. It's where there's probable cause to conduct any trespass onto property to search, to investigate person, houses, papers, and effects, which is what the Fourth Amendment says is protected. So, I mean, nowhere in the Fourth Amendment does it say you can only do that once. And indeed, if you have probable cause, you surely don't have to get a warrant each time you walk out of the house to your patrol car, because technically that's a new trespass each time. That's why I asked you the earlier question. You said it depends, but it sounds like it doesn't really depend.
Well, let me address that, Your Honor, in a couple ways. First of all, you set up a hypothetical of a person leaving and then coming back the same day or maybe even just moments later. Well, that might be, maybe that's permissible because one can construe that.
Wasn't that a new trespass, though?
I don't know that it is. I think that it can be reasonably construed as the same trespass. Where you really come into difficulty is if you have...
Let's make it the GPS tracker. Officer attaches it to the vehicle. That's the trespass, correct? Walks away from the vehicle and then hears something hit the ground and looks and sees that what he had affixed is no longer affixed. Can you go pick it up and put it back on?
Well, would we be talking about... I think probably he would be allowed to under those circumstances.
But that's two trespasses, isn't it?
I think that could, again, we're dealing with a situation where under precedent, that can reasonably be construed as a continuation of the same trespass. And I would say that the hypotheticals that we need to really confront are those that don't involve such a close span of time, because this wasn't a close span of time. This was 2 weeks.
Well, right. But if you're if you're using the common law of trespass, each of those things, whether separated by 15 seconds, 30 minutes, 5 days, 15 days, are two distinct trespasses. If you were going to file a tort suit, you could file for both of them. So if the key is a distinct trespass at common law, then why does time matter?
Well, there may be some flexibility, but I think it's the intent of the court, the Supreme Court, stays close to that analytical rubric as possible. One considers if you don't have them separated by moments, but you have them separated by days. If you those are clearly two separate trespasses under the common law. And if you had a warrant for
let me extend Judge Russell's hypothetical. Officer attaches the GPS device, the tracking device. And the next day, the next morning, it goes offline. Don't know what the problem is. The officer goes and removes it, determines that the thing is defective, or there's a loose wire, short circuit or something, replaces it with another tracking device. Are you suggesting he's got to get a new warrant to do that?
I think under the statute allows there to be maintenance, and I think that, again, I'm not sure that would be the case. What I would like to just mention is if the court gets...
The statute may say that, but if I understand your analysis, that part of the statute would be unconstitutional if it's a new trespass.
I think that the Supreme Court is clear this needs to be as close to analyze as a common law trespass as possible. And if under the court's reading, if the trespass, if we aren't reading it that way, then what would prevent the police from getting a search warrant for a home that ostensibly authorizes them to enter any time within 15 days and coming back to that house every single day? There'd be no difference under that scenario. Likewise, I would note that in subsequent cases, for example, Florida versus Jardine, you had a case of a dog sniffing. That was a dog sniffing on a porch. According to the court's analysis, what the court is suggesting in this hypothetical, if it isn't the trespass and they're authorized to come back every single day, well, then the police, with that warrant to sniff the porch, could come back with the dog every single day for 30 days or however many days. And that can't be authorized either.
Well, there's a lot of case law that says the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. And so it sounds like you're elevating form over substance, if you will. In other words, hypothetically, as long as there's probable cause that a crime is being committed and there's evidence of a crime in a certain place, and as long as you go and get the functional equivalent of a warrant, that satisfies the Fourth Amendment. It seems to me that continues to satisfy the Fourth Amendment as long as the scope of the warrant is not exceeded and as long as the probable cause continues to exist. Isn't that fundamental Fourth Amendment jurisprudence?
Your Honor, I think there is reasonableness, but I don't think that the Jones could be any clearer, and the following cases cannot be any clearer that we're talking about the actual physical act that must be supported by an individual probable cause determination. And I know that there's case law throughout.
Well, Jones doesn't say that. It seems to me you're extrapolating from Jones. All Jones says, in essence, is that there's a trespassory component to the Fourth Amendment, which had been rejected in 1961, I think it was, with Katz. They've gone back, and now we've got dual competing, if you will, Fourth Amendment considerations, both privacy and property interests. Jones has not been very specific beyond what it actually says. And so how are we to strike that balance?
Well, I think that, again, I would just simply rely on the fact that I believe that the language is clear. The policy implications are equally as bad if you view it in a flexible manner, which would permit daily entries, daily reattachments under this reading. And the only clear way to analyze this, and I think that was really the fundamental import of Jones, was let's come up with a clear test for this, because the other ones really don't lead us to a clear jurisprudential answer, and there's a very clear answer. There's a very clear test, and it's very simple. And it's if you intrude on the property of another, you need probable cause to do that. Every instance of that is a trespass. It's required to be supported by probable cause, and I would rely on that in my argument.
All right.
Thank you.
I made you use up almost all your rebuttal.
It's okay.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Katz.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth.
And Judge Humphreys, I'd like to start just by talking about the dates, because that appeared to be of interest to the court, and it may help the court in its analysis. So if I could briefly say that the search warrant was obtained on March 13th, 2013. That's at 336 of the joint appendix. The GPS tracking device was installed on March 19th. That's at 337 of the joint appendix. On March 20th, the following day, it was removed, 343 and 345 of the joint appendix, reinstalled on April 3rd, 346 of the joint appendix. And the order extending an additional 30 days was entered April 11th.
Now, do I understand correctly that the Commonwealth is not relying on the subsequent extension to justify the removal? In other words, is the Commonwealth's position that the subsequent extension is what requires affirmance, or is the Commonwealth's position that the original warrant prior to the removal covered what was done here?
Well, Your Honor, I have been vague in responding to what I think was a vague argument raised on appeal, and I have tried to respond to the points that the appellant
raised. I'm not going to let you be vague in response to my question.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we can analyze it either way, and I'm happy to do so, but I think as a threshold matter...
Well, let me stop you, because I suspect you'd be on a lot thinner ice if you're suggesting that an ex post facto ratification of probable cause is proper under the Fourth Amendment.
And if that troubles the court, I'm happy to focus my time with you today on an argument that may bear...
I'm not sure it troubles my colleagues, but it certainly does trouble me.
Well, I'd like to begin by saying I think at best what the appellant has raised is a challenge to the statute, and pursuant to Virginia v. Moore, there's simply no exclusion of evidence that would result if that is, in fact, the argument that has been raised.
Well, but you would agree that the statute wasn't complied with here, wouldn't you? The second installation was not completed within 15 days of the warrant, correct?
Well, I would assert that the language of the statute contemplates exactly what was done. And by giving voice to circumstances in which there may be need for maintenance, the General Assembly clearly contemplated a removal and a reattachment.
But the order itself provides, understanding the statute, but the form order that was created and the form order that was issued in this case requires the installation to be completed within 15 days of the order.
Well,
to the extent that this is not completed until the second attachment occurs, that did not occur within 15 days of the order, correct? I'm factually correct.
I would disagree as to what installation means in terms of that order and its time requirement, because it was installed. And I would submit that the subsequent reinstallation is not a new installation. It's merely a continuance of what was authorized in the order and the statute. And so the issue in this case concerns, well, what does the statute authorize? Are there circumstances in which you can take off and put back on, and what are the consequences of doing so? Is it, in fact, a new installation, or is it merely a continuation of the initial installation? And I would submit the best evidence as to what that means was the language the General Assembly used. And they clearly contemplated, when drafting this statute, circumstances in which it would be necessary to take some step to remove and to reinstall, and they failed to say specifically when you do so, that is a new installation. And so, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with the argument that there is a violation of the court's initial order. The reference to installation is the first installation, and the subsequent removal and reattachment does not amount to a new installation. We don't start the time.
But even if I disagree with you, it doesn't matter because the statute doesn't provide for exclusion.
Exactly.
That was what I was about to follow up on, because I just want to clarify the statute requiring that the installation take place within 15 days is not part of the scope of the search. It's simply a procedural requirement. The scope here is actually the 30-day period from the issuance of the warrant, which, if my math is correct, and I, by the way, I went to law school because I understood there'd be no math, but. But if my math is correct, the scope of this warrant would have expired on April 13th. Is that correct?
I believe that's right, Your Honor. And I would say, if all we're talking about is the statute, that's absolutely correct. There's simply no exclusionary rule that would apply here. And the General Assembly knows how to do that very well when they intend for that result. And I pointed out on brief the wiretap statute as an example where there's a very conspicuous and rigid requirement, and there are dire consequences if it's not followed with. And that's simply not the case here. But even turning to a Fourth Amendment analysis, if it can be construed that this brief raises a constitutional challenge and doesn't merely attack the statute, I would argue that the good faith exception ought to apply. And looking at Davis, and I cited Davis on brief, we don't have here a recklessness on the part of law enforcement. Exclusion would not be the appropriate remedy here. You have police officers who are scrupulously attempting to adhere to the requirements set forth by the General Assembly. And to the extent that counsel infers additional requirements that are not patent on the face of the statute, we can't punish law enforcement for that breach, if it is a breach. I mean, if this court construes what's been raised here as a constitutional challenge, that exclusion is a viable option, we simply don't have a requirement that remedy should follow because we don't have the bad faith of law enforcement. So I would submit, as an initial matter, what you have is a statutory challenge for which there should be no exclusion. But even if the court rejects that argument and finds that there is, in fact, a constitutional challenge, I would argue that the good faith exception should apply. And so we still should not have exclusion as a result. I'm happy to address any questions the panel may have as to that topic. I do want to say briefly regarding the admission of the photographs, we have the court's reliance on persuasive authority of Shirbhaji. And counsel in his reply brief argues a distinction between the best evidence rule and hearsay, but I would submit that it is persuasive and the analysis is similar, and the court engaged in that analysis. What was at issue in those photographs was simply not the content of the writing, it was the mere fact of their existence. And counsel in his reply brief urges this court to make a clear statement of jurisprudence and to distinguish the two, but I would submit that is the best evidence that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. If it is necessary to sharpen the jurisprudence in this regard, then it cannot be said that the trial court abused its discretion in relying on that persuasive authority. It is a similar analysis. It was a sound analysis. I do not concede that it was error at all. As regards the sufficiency of the evidence, I would rely on brief unless the court has any particular questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Katz. Mr. Haywood, you have 2 minutes. Did you want to address the good faith exception?
Certainly. And one aspect of good faith that's critical is establishing that the officers actually properly executed a warrant. Perhaps this is where the statutory issue comes into play. Leon itself stated that on page 918 of the opinion in footnote 19, said our discussion of the deterrent effect of excluding evidence.
Well, let me stop you, because why wouldn't it be good faith that the only evidence here, there's no evidence of bad faith, I mean overt evidence at least of bad faith, they have a piece of paper that says this authorization to affix this GPS device is good through April 13th. And why aren't they entitled to rely on that, you know, no matter how many so-called trespasses it takes to do so?
Well, it would require violating the terms of the warrant itself, which required it to be installed within 15 days. So the second installment is an installment. And if they installed it afterwards and they did not actually execute the warrant properly, and Leon would not apply in those instances. Moreover, they're operating at that point. It's not an issue where they have a warrant that they didn't know was supported by insufficient probable cause or something like that. They, according to our analysis, at the time of the second attachment, they simply didn't have a warrant at all. It was a warrantless attachment. So for both of those reasons, I don't think Leon would apply.
Do you want to address the admissibility of the of the photograph at all?
I think that my reply brief was pretty clear on that, and I think this is honestly it's a very clear issue that the best evidence test is not a hearsay test. We're dealing with the contents, not the truth of the contents, and that's exactly what was important in this case. And I beyond that, I would just rely on my reply brief from that point.
All right, court will come down and greet counsel.